speech to free minds. It's the David Knight Show.
It's Monday, March the 2nd, 2020. I'm David Knight, your host. Today we're going to take a look at the aftermath of Saturday's South Carolina primary and tomorrow's Super Tuesday. Very close together, and I think this thing is going to be pretty much wrapped up after tomorrow on the Democrat side. So we're going to talk about what happened. We had another two bite the dust over the weekend as a result of that, and it kind of indicates where things are headed. We'll also be talking about the coronavirus, the panic, the politics, and, of course, the profits or lack of them as we see industry being shut down everywhere. Is it going to be a greater economic depression? And, of course, we'll also take a look quickly at the disease itself. Should you fear the actual disease? Quite frankly, I'm far more concerned about what the government is going to do, using this as a means to push quarantines and untested vaccines, mandate vaccines. As I said last week, when you look at how they have used one or two cases of measles coming through and how they have basically mandated vaccination for school and so forth, I'm very concerned about how they're building this up and what they're going to do with it in terms of the end game. But before we get into any of that, I want to take a look at the spread of something else. Islam. We have Turkey now using as a weapon a mass overflow of immigrants. And, of course, you have a Turkish minister bragging about the fact that 76,000 Muslim migrants are invading Europe from Turkey. Erdogan has been using this as a pressure point, as a bargaining chip to get the European countries, NATO particularly, to come in on their side against Russia in the Syrian war. Because, again, he is trying to get Assad out of Syria because he wants a greater caliphate. And so he and Assad are fighting each other now in Syria using proxies. And because Europe has decided they don't want to get involved in that to on the side of Turkey, Turkey is now making good on his threat and invading Greece, which means that they will then propagate through the rest of Europe. Greece has now sent 50 naval vessels and commandos to block a refugee wave out of Turkey, and this is coming by sea for the most part. Greece sealed its key island border crossing with Turkey Friday, not island but land crossing, after Ankara declared that it is allowing its refugees to flee Idlib and onto Europe for at least 72 hours in response to Syrian-Russian airstrikes killing 33 Turkish troops Thursday. Now, this is not, these refugees are not coming from Syria. They're using this, again, as a pressure point, as an excuse, as a pretense to do what they have threatened to do. And they're trying to not only pull Europe in, but, of course, NATO in general. That means the United States. And Tulsi Gabbard has pushed back on that very strongly. But on Friday, we had Germany's Bild newspaper reported that Greece is taking further emergency measures to prevent Erdogan from effectively opening the gates on a new wave of refugees and migrant hordes trying to get in the European Union. So they have 50 naval ships, most of them small patrol vessels, have been deployed by the Greek Navy. And citing a top Greek government official, the German paper Bild reported further that this will include air support. Meanwhile, is this really in response? Is this a humanitarian response to what is going on in Syria? No, it isn't. As Front Page puts it, abandoning the pretense that the so-called refugee crisis is anything more than a military colonialism, Turkey's Erdogan has responded to military setbacks to discard his aid agreement with the EU. And the media under his control urged Muslim migrants to head to Europe. More on that when we come back. Then we'll take a look at Democrat politics. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
In a world of deceit, tell telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And now, the David Knight Show.
It's Monday, March the 2nd, year of our Lord, 2020. I'm David Knight, your host, and we're going to take a look at Democrat politics. We had a lot of developments over the weekend after the South Carolina primary on Saturday, and tomorrow is Super Tuesday, so we're going to be taking a look at that. We'll also take a look at what is going on with the developments and the coronavirus panic, as well as the coronavirus politics. But folks, we need to take a look quickly at what else is happening in the world as we are focused on our own internal politics out of Washington. And that is a very dangerous powder keg that has exploded on the border between Europe and Turkey, specifically in Greece. A massive number of Muslim migrants invading Europe. And this is not, as we've been, the Erdogan media are telling the public, this is not a humanitarian refugee crisis. That is a beard, because he has been using, trying to manipulate the EU and NATO to come to his aid to try to take over Syria. He's trying to expand his control into Syria. He's trying to set up another Ottoman Empire, or if you will, a worldwide caliphate. That's really been the plan of Erdogan, as well as Fethullah Gulen. Both of them wanted to put themselves at the head of a worldwide caliphate. But of course, you can only have one head. So the two of them eventually became enemies. Fethullah Gulen, brought here by the CIA, now given nearly $1 billion to set up Islamic promoting schools here in the U.S. That's right. They don't specifically promote Islam. They promote Turkish culture and teach students how to speak Turkish and so forth. And we pay for that as taxpayers. They send politicians, Republicans, not just Democrats, many Republicans, especially here in Texas, given junkets to Turkey so they can propagandize along with students. It is a massive movement here to control and to colonize the United States culturally. They have more than 1,000 schools worldwide, and everywhere else they are openly operating as Islamic madrasas. But here in the United States, they have to be more covert about that in order to get nearly $1 billion of U.S. money. And they operate typically as schools of science and math, and yet they bring in Turkish teachers who don't have any expertise in either of those subjects. That's the story for another day. I've talked many times to Mark Hall about that, but let's take a look at what's going on specifically now between Turkey and Greece. As frontpagemag.com points out, he has discarded his agreement, Erdogan has, with the European Union, and the media under his control is urging all Muslim migrants to head to Europe, and they have. And this is now an invasion. Tens of thousands of refugees from Syria and other countries were massing on the Turkish borders with Greece and Bulgaria last night, hurling stones at guards, trying to cut through razor wire. An estimated 30,000 migrants gathered at checkpoints after Turkey's president claimed to have opened the doors, quote-unquote, to allow as many as 4 million asylum seekers to leave the country. One of the first standoffs came Friday night in northeastern Greece, where hundreds of migrants, including Syrians, Iranians, Iraqis, Pakistanis, and Moroccans, demanded to be let in. Most of these are not Syrians. The only thing they have in common is their religion and their tradition of conquest and colonialism. They're not fleeing a civil war. They're mostly military-age young men invading Europe and anywhere else they can get to from Europe. Greece and Bulgaria are obviously outmatched, and these countries were the traditional targets of the Ottoman Empire. But it is not 30,000. Even Turkey's interior minister, Süleyman Soylu, is how you pronounce his last name, tweeted out, "The number of migrants leaving our country is 76,358 as of 9:55 a.m. Pretty specific, isn't it? How does he know about that? Is it because they're assisting them? Yes. We have reports from Greek officials in local towns saying that they are seeing Turkish soldiers cut the razor wire barriers to let migrants come in. It is actually a literal invasion of Greece by Turkey. If there's a role for NATO, it's not in Syria. It is to protect Europe from the Islamist invasion, writes Front Page. Turkey's decision comes amid frustration that the EU and NATO countries, including Britain, have failed to provide enough support in the country's war against Assad in Syria. On Thursday, 33 Turkish soldiers were killed by Syrian forces, dramatically raising tensions in a war in which Turkey and Russia are backing opposite sides. And they're trying to draw us in as the chief force in NATO. They're trying to draw us into a war with Russia so that we can support Erdogan's desires to have a worldwide caliphate. Greece has a migrant crisis, a powder keg ready to explode. The Greek government has announced that it's going to build new migrant camps on five Aegean islands. They expect to have them operational by July 2020. This is before any of this happened. And on February the 25th, more than 500 local Greeks prevented construction workers from accessing the site of a proposed new migrant camp on the island of Lesbos. And, of course, that island and several others are all close to Turkey, where they're planning to build these facilities. But now the Turkish government is no longer even pretending to try to hold back the wave of invasion. Thousands of migrants mass on Turkey's border with Europe, reports Breitbart. Turkish President Erdogan's decision to open his country's borders with Europe made good on a longstanding threat to let migrants into the continent. His announcement marked a dramatic departure from current policy, an apparent attempt to pressure Europe into offering Turkey more support in dealing with the fallout from the Syrian war. The UN's International Organization for Migration put the numbers very low. They said, well, at least 13,000. And they're grouping in between several dozen and more than 3,000 per group. But, of course, we have the Interior Minister very specific, not just about 76,000, but he was specific down to the last number. Greek authorities fired tear gas and stun grenades through Saturday to prevent repeated attempts by a crowd of more than 4,000 people massed at one border. They fought a cat and mouse struggle with groups that were cutting holes in the border fence along the border to crawl through. Stavros Zamalidis, president of a local community in Greece, said that Turkish soldiers are actively helping people cross the Greek border clandestinely. He said Turkish soldiers with cutters in their hands were cutting the wires of the fence to lead the illegal migrants into crossing the border. Erdogan has warned of an imminent operation against Assad's forces unless they pull back from Turkish lines in Syria by the end of February. And of course, as that deadline passed on Saturday night, Turkish drones bombed Syrian government targets in Idlib, and Turkish-backed rebels shelled Syrian army positions. In response now, Russia has deployed warships to the Syrian coast, and they may have been responsible for the 33 soldiers that were lost in Turkish soldiers that were lost in the attack. And so as this escalates, Tulsi Gabbard has called on President Trump not to get into a war with Russia in order to back this Islamic caliphate dictator. Trump had reportedly told Erdogan in a phone call last week as this crisis was escalating that he reaffirmed support for Turkey in Idlib. Ankara is now demanding greater support from NATO as well after the 33 troops were believed to have been killed by Russian jets. Tulsi Gabbard, meanwhile, said the United States, quote, will not be dragged into a war with Russia by aggressive Islamist expansionist dictator of Turkey via NATO. And she wants President Trump to make that clear. She also slammed the mainstream media's efforts to renew holding up al-Qaeda terrorists on the ground as Idlib and mere rebels and freedom fighters. She said Turkey's been supporting ISIS and al-Qaeda terrorists from behind the scenes for years. They want to create an Islamist caliphate in Syria, reestablish the Islamist Ottoman Empire, and work with al-Qaeda to do it. He is not a friend of America. He's one of the most dangerous dictators in the world. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Another one bites the dust.
least two that bit the dust over the weekend after the South Carolina primary. The first one to bite the dust was Tom Steyer. He threw the towel in immediately on Saturday, even though he had his best showing so far. He basically didn't even show up as a blip in Iowa and New Hampshire. But he bet it all in South Carolina. He put $24 million in TV and social media advertising in South Carolina, but he did not win the 15%, which is a threshold for getting delegates. And so he got absolutely nothing, nothing in South Carolina. And so he, later that day, as soon as results were in and he found out that he got a big goose egg, he dropped out. And California Globe asks, was Tom Steyer's campaign the worst campaign in presidential history? They said a strong case can be made that Tom Steyer has just concluded the worst campaign in the history of presidential politics. You know, you look at this and you say, how did this guy get $1 billion to be this stupid? Well, the answer is he's a banker. Yeah, he's a California-based founder of Farallon Capital, co-founder of a couple of other banks, One California Bank and Beneficial State Bank. Oh, there you go. You know, if you own a couple of banks, it's very easy to become a billionaire. Doesn't mean that you have to know anything, right? He spent $253 million through January the 31st. And then most of the money, as I pointed out, has been dropped in South Carolina after that. All but $3.5 million was from his own pocket. So he's spent $250 million. So now I guess he's a three-quarter billionaire. I don't know how many billions he had. But just take a look at his return on his investment, if you're going to be somebody who's in business. But, of course, if you are a Democrat, you didn't get there because you built it, right? Obama's right about that. Democrat billionaires didn't get there because they built it. They got there because they stole it, for the most part. That's the way these people operate. Steyer failed to get a single delegate in spite of spending $250 billion of his own and $3 million of other people's money. He spent, depending on accounts, like I said, at least $18 million, according to New York Times. Others put it in the mid-20s. So let's just say that he spent about $280 million. He got a seventh-place finish in Iowa, 3,000 votes. He got a sixth-place finish in New Hampshire, 10,700 votes. No delegates in either of those. And then in Nevada, he spent $13.5 million on TV ads. His 9,500 first alignment votes were the sixth most and, again, failed to capture a single delegate. In South Carolina, with 99% of the total counted, he had finished in third place with 59,814 votes. But that was still less than a quarter of what Joe Biden got. And because he only got 11.4% of the state vote, that means that he doesn't get any delegates there either in that fourth one. So the bottom line is that he got about 80,000 votes and he spent $280 million. That means that he spent about $3,500 per vote. $3,500 per vote. Kind of puts a whole new perspective on what these elections are about, doesn't it? And he wasn't the only one who bit the dust. The next day, yesterday, we had Booty Gay bid Booty Buy. Let's play a little bit of a clip of this. Video clip number 6.
One of those values is truth. And today is a moment of truth. After a year of going everywhere, meeting everyone, defying every expectation, seeking every vote, the truth is that the path has narrowed to a close for our candidacy, if not for our cause. And another of those values is responsibility. And we have a responsibility to consider the effect of remaining in this race any further. Our goal has always been to help unify Americans to defeat Donald Trump and to win the era for our values. And so we must recognize that at this point in the race, the best way to keep faith with those goals and ideals is to step aside and help bring our party and our country together. So tonight, I am making the difficult decision to suspend my campaign for the presidency.
And so exactly how is he going to bring the party together? Well, you know, as he bowed out, he and Biden traded voicemails. And even though he didn't endorse anybody. And I'll just point out that amongst besides his LGBT credentials, he is the one of the youngest people to ever run for office. So he's probably telling Joe Biden, you know, I would be a great counter to one of the most senile people to ever run for office. And as they try to combine forces to try to stop Bloomberg and Bernie tomorrow, we'll see what happens. Things may develop pretty quickly. President Trump immediately said, as Buttigieg bid Buttigieg buy, he said, this is the real beginning of the Democrats taking Bernie out of play. That was President Trump's take on this. So as we look at this, as New York Times notes, in the last presidential debate on Tuesday in South Carolina, just last Tuesday, Buttigieg forcefully warned that nominating Bernie would lead to crushing defeat in the fall. And he said, not just four more years of Donald Trump, but loss of the Democrat House majority secured by moderate candidates who won in suburban swing districts in 2018. So then that takes us to South Carolina itself. And again, over the weekend, we had Biden with a big victory in South Carolina, which brings his delegate total up close to Bernie Sanders. As reported by NBC News right now, Sanders has 60 delegates, Biden 53, Booty, who just dropped out, had 26. And then you have Warren and Klobuchar with 8 and 7, respectively. So they are very, very far behind. So the question is, having won his first primary ever, can Joe Biden win the White House? This is pointed out by American Thinker that this is his third presidential campaign, Biden's. And this is the first time in three presidential campaigns that he's won a single primary. This is the great hope of the Democrat mainstream party, Joe Biden. And so they said, here's three possibilities. Number one, you have the Sanders juggernaut resume tomorrow on Super Tuesday and sweep aside Biden's South Carolina win. Or number two, Sanders no longer looks unstoppable, breathing life into the anybody but that crazy Marxist movement and pushing Biden to the forefront as the safest candidate. Or number three, Democrats look at the choice of Biden and Bernie, and they decide to allow themselves to be bought by Bloomberg through a brokered convention. Now, let's talk about option number two, as he points out. What happens if they push Biden forward? Well, he's got two glaring problems. Corruption. That is the real takeaway from this failed impeachment. And I said that from the very beginning. I said there were forces in the Democrat Party who are really angling at Biden as much as they were at President Trump. And then, of course, there's the stupidity angle or the senility angle, and we'll talk about that when we come back. Stay with us. Biden in South Carolina, he's gotten his southern drawl on, and he was pretty popular down there, and he is calling on Obama. Oh, bro, Obama, where art thou, brother? Because I am a man of constant sorrow, and I need your help, and he may be coming to his rescue, many people have pointed out. As a matter of fact, a New York Post op-ed piece by John Podhoretz said, look at how Obama was helped in South Carolina when he ran for when he won in 2008. And the thing that really turned it around for him is he won the South Carolina primary, heavily getting the African-American vote, as Joe Biden did. And then 2 days later, you had Ted and Caroline Kennedy endorse Obama instead of Hillary Clinton, who he beat there by 30 points. Now, Biden beat Bernie by 20 points on Saturday. And Obama spokesman Robert Gibbs said Saturday after the South Carolina primary that the Kennedy endorsements were extraordinarily important to the Obama campaign. That's what turned it around. So he beats Hillary Clinton by a large margin in South Carolina, and then he gets the endorsement of the Kennedys after that. And as the New York Post writer points out, think how much more crucial it'd be right now if Obama finally followed suit and endorsed Joe Biden. Because back in 2008, there was a 10-day gap between the South Carolina primary and Super Tuesday. However, we've only got, what is it, 2 days? A gap between the two, because we had the primary in South Carolina on Saturday. Tomorrow is Super Tuesday. So if Obama is going to do something, you better do it quickly, or you're going to have a man of constant sorrow on your hands here. So is he going to, as asked John Podhoretz, is Obama going to stand by as his party takes extremely risky step of nominating an open socialist? Because, you know, they are socialists. Let's understand that. They just don't want to openly talk about that. But we'll talk about just how socialist the mainstream of the Democrat Party is. But are you going to nominate an open socialist? And when 60% of Americans have an unfavorable view of socialism, fewer than 30% have a favorable view of socialism. And then he points out, unchallenged, Bloomberg's money is just going to help Sanders by taking away chunks of the non-Sanders vote. And what other effective challenge could there be to Scrooge McDuck in his swimming pool full of dollars and the most popular Democrat in the country anointing his preferred choice? Unless that is, Obama's preferred choice is a brokered convention from which a surprise nominee emerges named Michelle Obama. I don't think that's going to be the case, quite frankly. I don't think Michelle Obama wants to run this time. I think she wants to wait until 2024 when she won't be running against an incumbent president. And we shortly after saw Obama breaking his silence. He made a phone call of congratulation to Joe Biden. And you might say, well, you know, that's just being nice, right? Except he hasn't done that in any of the other previous three contests to any of the other winners. There were no reports of Obama calling Buttigieg after he won Iowa, or calling Sanders after he won New Hampshire or Nevada. But when Biden wins, he did call him. And as I pointed out, you have Buttigieg calling Biden and Biden calling Buttigieg. They're exchanging voicemails after he got out of the race. So it looks like the establishment is now coalescing around Biden. It looks, I think, like Buttigieg is positioning himself for a VP slot, as you've got a match of old and young with Biden and with Buttigieg there. And he desperately needs somebody who can think on their feet, because he had an interview, Biden did, with Chris Wallace yesterday. And I just want to play this for you. It's very illustrative of where Biden's problems are. It's not just the corruption. It's this. Let's play video clip number one.
Mr. Vice President, I don't especially like asking you about this, but it is an issue in the campaign, and that has been your sometimes shaky performance on the campaign trail. Here's a story that you told at least three times about Nelson Mandela. Take a look.
I had the great honor of meeting him. I had the great honor of being arrested with our UN ambassador on the streets of Soweto trying to get to see him on Robben's Island.
You now say you weren't arrested and it didn't happen in Soweto. You were at the airport in Johannesburg and you were stopped from going through the door for blacks. I guess the question is, were you confused or were you just trying to embellish a story?
No. No, what I was doing was talking about the fact that I was strongly opposed to apartheid. When we landed in the first, we were going to Soweto, actually. We landed in Johannesburg, and the Afrikaners took me off the plane and took me in one direction, wanted me to go through a white-only door, and in fact, I wouldn't move. I said, everybody else is going through another door. I'm going with the black delegation that I came with. They said, no, you can't. And I said, well, I'm standing here. I'm not going to move. And they would not let me move anywhere. So I guess I should have said I was detained. I was not able to move forward. So what they finally did was they went out and they cleared out a baggage claim area. Took
a
us
new
all
story
through,
here. Here's a new story.
Through the baggage claim area
and
cleared
pop.
Out a restaurant. Look, and if anybody wonders whether or not what I said about my desire and my adamancy about apartheid, you've covered it. Go back and look at JoeBiden.com and take a look at the what's happened in the...
Your record is clear.
Anyway.
Let me ask you, though, here's something else you said this week. Take a look.
I'm a Democratic candidate for the United States Senate. Look me over. If you like what you see, help out. If not, vote for the other guy. Give me a look, though, okay?
You haven't run for the Senate since 2008. What happened there?
Joe Biden for Senate.
The context was, I said to everybody, I said, look, I'm going to say the same thing that I've always said. Like I used to campaign in Delaware. I'd say, I'd knock on the door. I said, my name is Joe Biden, Democratic candidate for the United States Senate. Look me over. If you like me, help me out. If not, vote for the other guy. That's a sentence I repeated throughout making the case. And I said, and I'm here now to ask you all to look me over. It was in the context of how I said I ran, because the context was that you can't, as was pointed out by my Cedric and others of my campaign and how I ran when I ran for the Senate was people will not, they expect you to ask them. You have to earn their vote. That was the context of that.
All right. Final question in this regard. President Trump went after you about this at CPAC yesterday. Take a look at what he said.
Joe's not going to be running the government. He's just going to be sitting in a home someplace. And people are going to be running it for him.
Your response to the president.
Is that the stable genius saying that? Oh, give me a break. God love him. But I'm not going to try to, assign names and insults to the stable genius. This is a guy
didn't he just do that with stable
genius?
Doing.
He doesn't know how to run the country. He is making us more unsafe the way he's responding to the coronavirus. He has done virtually nothing well that I can see. And so I can hardly wait to debate him on stage. I want people to see me standing next to him and him standing next to me.
I want to see that.
We'll see who's sleepy.
Mr. Vice President, thank you. Thanks for your time. Please come back in less than 13 years, sir.
Wait for this. Listen.
All right, Chuck. Thank you very much.
All right, Chuck.
All right. It's Chris,
anyway. Chris. I just did Chris. No, I just did Chuck. I tell you what, man, these are back to back. Anyway.
No, it's
I don't
okay.
Know how you do it early in the morning, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, he's still feeling kind of sleepy,
trip,
isn't he?
You, sir.
I don't know how you thank do this you. Early in the morning. Yeah, he's not sleepy, is he? He's not sleepy, Joe Biden. I tell you what, that's a bunch of malarkey and balderdash, I think, quite frankly. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. And look, as I pointed out before, and I've had interviews with Simon Roche out of South Africa. He was somebody who was working with the ANC as a white man. He said, I didn't like apartheid. I'm a Christian. I oppose that. But understand that Nelson Mandela and the people who were with him, Winnie Mandela, the people who succeeded him, are Marxists. And you can see their plans of confiscation and murder and racism now in South Africa. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Working starts to make me wonder where fruits of what I do are going. He says in love and war all is fair. He's got cards he ain't showing. How much does it cost? I'll buy it. The time is all we've lost. I'll try it. And he can't even.
Welcome back. You just heard Joe Biden as he was confronted by Chris Wallace, who later he said, thanks, Chuck. Appreciate it. It's Chris, by the way, Mr. Vice President. Remember that next time you run for senator, as you're doing now. Anyway, he said, yeah, I don't know how you do it, getting up this early in the morning. He just talked about how President Trump mocked him by calling him sleepy. He said, yeah, we'll see who's sleepy when we get in those debates. And so, well, I don't know how to do it or this early in the morning. Anyway, going back to the beginning of that interview where he's talking about the ludicrous claims that he made about Nelson Mandela trying to pander to the black vote in South Carolina, and he did it. successfully. It just goes to show that you can make ridiculous claims and get away with it. Because even the Washington Post called it a ridiculous claim. Biden's ridiculous claim that he was arrested trying to see Mandela. And let's understand exactly what he had to say, because here's a quote from the Washington Post. You heard him dance around that and say, well, you know, what it was I actually got diverted and detained a little bit at the airport and so forth. No, no, no. He said this day, 30 years ago, he said this on February 11th, this day, 30 years ago, very specific, Nelson Mandela walked out of prison and entered into discussions about apartheid, and I had the great honor of meeting him this day, 30 years ago. I had the great honor of being arrested with our UN ambassador on the streets of Soweto. Not detained at the airport. He was arrested on the streets of Soweto, trying to get to see him on Robben's Island. Now, looking at this and going back and forth and saying, yeah, he pushed for sanctions against South Africa because of apartheid. But no, this is absolutely ridiculous, the claims that he's making in South Carolina. They said, on the eve of a primary that is critical to his election hopes, Biden suddenly recalls being arrested in South Africa and being thanked later by Nelson Mandela for having been arrested. As the Washington Post writes, there is no evidence for either claim. Neither appears remotely credible. So Biden gets four Pinocchios, which is about as bad a lie claim as rating that you can get from the Washington Post with their Pinocchio allocations. And then, of course, Chris Wallace didn't even bring up, there's so many of them, such a target-rich environment for Joe Biden. He claims to have worked on the 2016 Paris climate deal with a Chinese leader who died in 1997. And, of course, that kind of makes sense. I mean, if you can put together a climate deal with a dead Chinese leader who's been dead for 19 years, then perhaps what you'll be able to do is get some of those voters who died to vote for you as well in various Democrat jurisdictions. He said while he was campaigning in South Carolina a week ago on Monday, last Monday, he claimed that he worked on the Paris Climate Accord with Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping, who died 19 years before the agreement was signed. So can you take anything the man says seriously? Nevertheless, when we look at what's coming up tomorrow, it comes down to Bernie, Biden, and Bloomberg, the three Bs. Bernie has the momentum, Bloomberg has the money, and Biden has the black vote. You got 14 states and entities will be holding primaries tomorrow. University of Virginia political science professor Larry Sabato said the best guess right now is that Biden will be favored in most of the southern states because of a sizable African-American voting. Sanders has a clear edge in California, partly because of a big liberal vote and also Hispanic vote. And that may also help him in Texas as well. So it's not clear exactly what's going to be happening, but this is basically where Bloomberg is going to win big or go home, I think, because he has bet everything on this. He has arranged things so that he doesn't participate in the debates, you know, saying, well, you know, they want to have as a threshold, you got to be at a certain point in the polls, or you have to, and certain amount in the polls, and you have to have a certain amount of money that you have raised from individual contributors. I said, I'm not taking anybody's money. What a virtue that is, he says. And so that was his way to stay out, to dodge the debates for a while until they changed the rules. And I said at the time, they're doing that not to help him. They're doing that because they don't want him conducting his campaign solely with slick TV ads that he's buying so far, $400 million that he's bought so far of that. But then let's take a look first at Bernie before we get into Bloomberg. Senator Rick Scott, the former governor of Florida, who is now a Florida senator, said that Bernie can now kiss Florida goodbye after what he said about Castro. He said, you're not going to have people who fought against socialism vote for it again. Actually, they didn't vote for it, Rick. It was imposed upon them. They didn't vote for it the first time. Scott said most Democrats favor socialism, but they will avoid making that public. That's right. He said Bernie Sanders is the only Democrat being honest. He says what he believes. The others are all socialists. They just aren't saying it. Let's go back to Cuba for a second. He said, let's remember, Castro had firing squads. There was a lady that I gave a Freedom Award to. She got her hand chopped off by the Castro regime. Why? She had complained that they were going to close a school in her community. How about that, Bernie? You talk about how Castro was all about adding schools and health care for everybody. And when a woman complained that a school was being closed, they chopped her hand off. But I'm sure they gave her excellent health care, don't you think, patching that up, the nub that she had? And what Scott said about Democrats wanting socialism is absolutely true. We look at the fact that Bernie Sanders has now raised in this last month $46.5 million in February. And so he's putting in some TV ad buys and nine of the Super Tuesday states. That was nearly double what he raised back in January. In January, he got $25 million, and he got $46.5 million in February. Most of this is coming from individual donors. That tells you, folks, that the base of the Democrat Party are Marxists. Let's understand that. They're Marxists. They're socialists. They're totalitarians. They want to control everything from a central location, and they want to control every detail of your life in a most authoritarian way. They don't want anybody to have more than they have, and they're going to level everybody. That's the programs that we see from each and every one of these candidates. A morning consult poll released on Friday showed that Sanders is leading among Super Tuesday voters by double digits. Yes, this socialist, this Marxist is now the preference of the Democrat base. This is why you see people like Nancy Pelosi coming along. She said, well, I'm not going to support socialism. She had said before she wasn't going to support AOC's Green New Steel, but she's now come on board with both of those. Meanwhile, you got Bernie flying with three private jets at all times. How's that? I guess it kind of matches with his three mansions that he's got, totaling $2 million in real estate property. So times have changed. This Marxist, this socialist, has got a lot of money now. Isn't that funny how that always happens? These Marxists, these socialists get into office by telling you that you need to take down the rich people. Give me power. I'll take down the rich people. I'll make you rich. And yet they make themselves rich. He has so many jets, as a matter of fact, three of them, that he accidentally boarded the wrong one. Yeah. Okay. Three Gulfstreams. And he doesn't even know which one. Earlier this month, he was spotted boarding a private aircraft while Liz Warren got her own jet as they both flew back to D.C. from different locations just 36 minutes apart. They could have flown together. They could have jet pooled. They're always nagging us, so we got a carpool, right? Shame on you. You got one person driving in a single car. We can take that away from you, and yet he's got three jets. So many, he doesn't even know which one to get on. TMZ is saying, well, you know, it's just bound to happen. You know, things like that just happen when you're a multimillionaire socialist. Folks, we've got to take a quick break. Before we do, I just want to remind you that what keeps this program and InfoWars going are the products that we have at InfoWarsStore.com. We have some great sales for you. We have DNA Force now back in stock. We have Vitamin Mineral Drink Mix. We have that now back in stock so that you can get a wide selection of multivitamins, minerals, and amino acids without taking a lot of pills. You need to make sure that you are in great shape if you're concerned about the coronavirus. What I'm concerned more about, however, as I'm concerned about shortages, I'm concerned about economic shutdowns. We're going to cover that. It's absolutely amazing to me how the economic shutdowns have spread all out of proportion, in my opinion, to the threat that is involved. But that is going to have real consequences for you if you can't find food on the shelves. And if you get some of our storable food, even if you don't need it now, you'll have it available for 25 years. Non-GMO, made in America. And right now, we are shipping food product at about 100 times our normal volume. I'm serious. That means that we have now stretched out the supply times. And you need to put this in advance. It's now taking 8 weeks or more in some rare cases. And this is going to get longer with each passing minute.
Free speech to free minds. It's the David Knight Show.
Keep on turning.
Yeah, isn't it amazing? We now have socialist Bernie Sanders. He's got three homes worth $2 million. He's got three jets that he's taking everywhere. It's confusing. And TMZ thought it was kind of funny that he got onto the wrong plane and then had to get off. And, you know, they saw him getting on a plane. Then he got off and got onto another plane. It's like, whoops. I said, well, you know, it's kind of funny that he has this kind of little mix-up because mistakes like this, you know, getting on the wrong Gulfstream, are just bound to happen, you know, when you're a multimillionaire communist. And as PJ Media comments, they said, yeah, socialists who campaign on the issues of climate change and wealth inequality rail against the super wealthy, often get on the wrong private jet all the time. Yeah, they do, quite frankly. And talking about hypocrisy, we have Elizabeth Warren, who is circling the drain, along with Amy Klobuchar. I don't think they're going to survive after tomorrow. But Elizabeth Warren had, in just a couple of weeks, she'd been saying, I'm totally against taking big money and super PACs and so forth. She said, yeah, everybody on this stage, except for Amy and me, is either a billionaire or getting help from PACs that do unlimited spending. So if you really want to live where you say, then put your money where your mouth is and say no to PACs. And then 2 weeks later, less than 2 weeks later, both Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar are accepting help from super PACs. There you go. But she says that regardless of how poorly she's doing, she's not going to give up. She's got a delegate strategy. I don't know what that is, considering how far behind she is. Both she and Amy Klobuchar only have like six or seven delegates each. And she is in such serious trouble that it looks like she may lose Massachusetts to Bernie. She may lose her home state to Bernie tomorrow. But she's not going to give up. And she is touting her 2-cent tax plan. Think about this. This really defines this woman. The lies that she tells. That's why I think Liawatha is probably the best way to describe her. She's talking when she says, I've got a 2-cent tax plan here. Well, she's talking about a 2% tax. And I've talked about this before, how local officials will lie to you. I remember back in North Carolina, I mentioned this last week. You had a 6% sales tax. They wanted to take it to 7% at the time. And they said, it's just a penny. It's just a penny tax. No. If you go from 6% to 7%, that's a 1/6 increase. That's 16.7% increase, not a penny. A 16.7% increase. And now she's saying, well, I'm just going to give you a 2-cent tax. It'll just be 2% of your income increased tax, right? Now, this is the way these demagogues lie to people. Liawatha, and it looks like she will lose in her home state most likely tomorrow. And another one who may lose her own home state is Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota, because she was campaigning Sunday night, last night. She had protesters take over the campaign rally in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. They were upset about the about Myron Burrell. They had signs that chanted "Free Mayan." They said he was wrongfully prosecuted for 2002 murder of a child. And so this is the Black Lives Matter group that was protesting Amy Klobuchar. And I think as we've seen what has happened in Minnesota in terms of Ilhan Omar and others who have also bought into the radical Green New Steel of AOC, I don't think that she is probably going to even carry her own home state. So what we will have tomorrow with Super Tuesday is we will have the vote divvied up between Bernie, Biden, and Bloomberg. And when we come back, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to take a look at Michael Bloomberg, the man who is so much smarter than you and has no problem telling you that either. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And now, the David Knight Show.
Welcome back. So after the South Carolina primary on Saturday, we have had the race narrow considerably. We had Buttigieg drop out. We had Steyer. You may ask who? And you would be correct to ask that because he had absolutely no effect other than helping the local economy by buying TV ads for TV stations. Both of them dropped out. And then we have Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren circling the drain with virtually no delegates and very poor showings everywhere and even in trouble in their own home state. So what we're looking at tomorrow on Super Tuesday, 14 states and other jurisdictions holding primaries. And what is at stake is about 34% of all the pledged delegates. Now, Michael Bloomberg has set up his strategy to make sure that he did not participate in the debates, and we saw why. He did two debates so far, and we could see why he did not want to get into those debates. He wanted to run TV ads, spending hundreds of millions of dollars, quite literally, before Super Tuesday, and to enter based on his TV image. That was tarnished considerably with the two debates. But we will see what happens tomorrow. And as a matter of fact, he explained why, let's get video clip number two, he explained why he got into the race. You know, he just had to because he looked at these other candidates and he said their ideas made no sense to me whatsoever. Oh, well, I agree with him on that. Here's Mike Bloomberg on why he entered the race. Video clip number two.
You told everybody who would listen that you're not running for president.
I did.
What changed?
I started watching and listening to the candidates, and they had ideas that made no sense to me whatsoever. Donald Trump's going to eat him for lunch.
I agree with both of those things. I think Trump will eat him for lunch, and I think their ideas make absolutely no sense at all. However, as I pointed out, Bernie Sanders is getting a tremendous amount of money, and it's escalating from his base. And these are individual contributors. These are not Michael Bloomberg's intelligentsia friends that are giving money to Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders really does represent the grassroots of the Democrat Party, and that's why we should all be very, very concerned about the fact that there are so many people in America that are embracing a man that praised Fidel Castro. That's just absolutely unbelievable to me. Having grown up in Florida, having understood that, a guy who spent his honeymoon in the Soviet Union just before it collapsed and still thinks it was great stuff. An apologist for communists. And again, as I played last week, even Fidel Castro did not want to say that he was a communist in 1965. Remember, he was put into power largely with the help of the CIA and big business because they didn't like what was going on with the previous occupant there and Batista. So with the corruption that was going on there, the CIA said, yeah, we can put this guy in. We can manage him. And so they helped him to get in. And then about a year later, as he had been confiscating American property from big business and nationalizing industries and making it very clear that he was a communist, they arranged the Bay of Pigs. And then he went on to make not only act like a communist, but to make an alliance with the Soviet Union, the friends of Bernie Sanders, and accepting missiles. And so we had the Cuban Missile Crisis the year after that. And then the year after that, we had JFK assassinated. And then that brings us to 1965, and he makes another trip to America where he had been feted and celebrated probably with Bernie Sanders at the big Fidel Mania Central Park concert. They had 30,000 people there. Bernie Sanders was either in high school or in Brooklyn College at that point in time. I can imagine that he could hoof it over there to watch his Marxist idol holding court there. And yet, when he came in 1965, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, after nationalizing all the industries in Cuba and so forth, he refused to call himself a communist. He didn't even want to call himself a socialist. That was Fidel Castro. Bernie Sanders, just think about this. Bernie Sanders is proud of his socialist, Marxist, communist past, more so even than Fidel Castro. And he's proud of Fidel Castro. Fidel Castro wanted to paint himself as a humanist. And you should understand that when our educational system says that they're celebrating secular humanism by purging God out of the schools, that what we're going to get is a bunch of Marxists. And that, now we're seeing that. We're seeing a massive swell of grassroots support for Bernie. But let's take a look at Bloomberg. He said, with an interview with CBS over the weekend, he said a few years ago, there was a revolution against the intelligentsia. See, that's him. That's him. He's smarter than you. He's smarter than all you common fools, all you people like, you know, you deplorables out there. He knows better what you should be allowed to have, what you should be allowed to eat and drink and smoke and so forth. And so he's going to tell you what to do. He said a few years ago, there was a revolution against the intelligentsia. People said, you know, those people are trying to tell us what to do. That's right. That's right. You're trying to tell us what to. He's got a plan for every detail of your life, and he's going to order you around just like he didn't have a constitution. Because as far as he's concerned, there is no constitution. There's no Bill of Rights. He said, you know, these people, they said, are trying to tell us what to do, and they wanted to change. And that explains Donald Trump. That's right. We're tired of being ordered around. And so if we got somebody who even offers us a glimmer of hope that the government is going to boss us around a little bit less. I mean, Donald Trump certainly doesn't support individual liberty. Far from it. As a matter of fact, you know, the Trump administration is telling you you can't use your own stem cells to treat your body. They're telling you you can't use vaping, right? We're going to shut that down and so forth. We're not going to let you have medical marijuana. So they don't support any individual liberty. They don't support due process. You know, we just have to take the guns. Maybe we do the due process later. All the red flag gun stuff, that was given a shot in the arm by Donald Trump. He has no appreciation for civil liberties, but he's not nearly as bad as Michael Bloomberg. Oh, this guy just can't wait to tell you everything to do. He said, now these people seem to have changed. He said, these people who said we don't want somebody telling us what to do, he said, now this cycle, people want stability. Stability. Yeah, you know, you can get stability if you go to a prison. You can be real safe in a prison, right? No, not actually. You can die in a prison. Just ask the family of Jeffrey Epstein, assuming he's got any family. Does he have any family? No. Bloomberg in South Carolina, not on the ballot and not liked. As a matter of fact, Reuters pointed out in exit polls that 70% of the people had an unfavorable opinion of Bloomberg as they were leaving the polls in South Carolina. He had an unfavorable rating of 70%. Joe Biden, on the other hand, had a favorable rating of 80%. The other six candidates on the ballot had favorable ratings of 50%. So everybody except for Biden and Bloomberg on the ballot in South Carolina, it was a toss-up. You know, 50% favorable, 50% unfavorable. For Bloomberg, he has 70% unfavorable, while Biden had 80% favorable. And that's no malarkey. And if you look at how this played out, Bloomberg goes to a black church in Selma, Alabama, and you've seen this yesterday. From yesterday, he goes there on a day that they celebrate violence against the civil rights movement in Selma, Alabama, and they had a lot of people who stood up. Show some B-roll of that, video clip number 5. They stand up, and they turn their backs on Bloomberg as he's speaking in a black church, and they remain standing throughout the event. Now, I think he's got a problem, don't you? I think he's an arrogant elitist who is throwing black people up against the wall and taking their guns. And we're talking about how much money that costs the city of New York in lawsuits. Yeah, we're talking about over $1 billion. He has absolutely no interest in individual liberty of anybody. It's not just black people, of anybody. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Yes, as we were talking before we went to break, you had Bloomberg going to a black church in Selma, Alabama, in a several people in the congregation stood up and turned their back to him the entire time that he was speaking. And here's the context of why they were angry, as you have Democracy Now! Pointing out, with Amy Goodman interviewing Bob Hennelly. Hennelly, I think is his name. He was a beat reporter, he said. And he said, when I was covering this in New York, he said, from his perspective, he thought it was a form of armed apartheid. He says it's really important to understand that, that in areas this was used as this kind of a strategy. She pointed out, we're talking about 5 million incidents of stop and frisk. 5 million. She said it's not a few bad apples. 5 million. Many young people, especially black and brown young men, but young women also were stopped. Stopped numerous times as they grew up in New York City by the stop and frisk policy. And as a result, New York City got hit with $1 billion in civil suits over police misconduct. So how's that for leadership, right? No, it's another example of absolute contempt for our liberties. I'll just say one more thing about this church event, however. You know, it's okay, and we've seen this over and over again. We have this thing called the Johnson Amendment that was put in by LBJ because he was opposed by some churches here in Texas when he was running for Senate. And so he goes to the IRS and he says, I want you to put in a rule. And they did it for him. And they called it an amendment. And so they hold this forth as if this is some kind of a constitutional amendment that takes precedent over the First Amendment. No, the First Amendment is a real amendment. And this is nothing but an IRS ruling done at the behest of Lyndon Johnson. And what it's supposed to say is that it pretends that if you have a church and you take an explicit political stand of endorsing somebody, then you could lose your 501c3 status and the IRS could come after you, and more specifically, after everybody that donated money to your church and then took it as a tax deduction, creating a big ball of pain for everybody. And so they use that to intimidate pastors not to talk about politics. And yet, that rule doesn't apply to liberal churches, typically black churches where people are welcome to go speak. And how clueless that Michael Bloomberg would go to a black church on a Sunday in which they celebrate Bloody Sunday, the 55th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, when police attacked civil rights marchers. Here's the guy behind stop and frisk, 5 million people up against the wall. We know what they look like. You know, you can just Xerox this and send it off. It's young black men just up against the wall and, you know, slam them against the wall. And they get $1 billion worth of civil suits because of that, because of doing that to 5 million people. So he decides it'd be a great idea. The geniuses that he has paid for. You're talking about these billionaires not getting much for their money. Tom Steyer spending $250 million of his $1 billion running TV ads, and he got nothing out of it. Spent about $3,500 per vote that he got. And he got zero delegates. And now you got Michael Bloomberg with his army of specialists decide that it'd be a great thing for him to go to a black church on the day that they are celebrating police brutality to civil rights marchers. The guy behind stop and frisk. Brilliant move. But it also illustrates the hypocrisy of the Johnson Amendment. And as I pointed out many times, you have the free speech, Pulpit Freedom Sunday, I think is what they called it. And it started out with just a couple of churches who explicitly talked about candidates in light of things like religious freedom or pro-life and mentioned names. And they did a recording of it and they sent it to the IRS and defied them to do something about it. And the IRS didn't do it. And so every year it has grown larger and larger, because we still have a First Amendment. The Johnson Amendment is not an amendment. President Trump says he's removed it, but of course it has not been removed. It has been scuttled by tricks in the Senate, just as they have played that kind of game with the infanticide bill, the Born Alive bill. They could have passed that bill, but instead they played games with it to pretend that they were really on your side, but they're not going to let that issue go away because that is a wedge issue that they use to get elected, and they don't want that to disappear. Meanwhile, as we look at this disastrous event, I can hardly wait to see what happens with Bloomberg's campaign having 2,400 events in 30 states ahead of Super Tuesday. Now, clearly, Mike Bloomberg can't be in that many locations in one day or 2 days. So he's going to have a lot of surrogates. And that really is a good thing for him, that he puts surrogates out there. Because when he shows up in person, this is what it looks like. I was absolutely amazed to see this account in New York Magazine. The headline of this is, "Nevertheless, he persists." And this is about Mike Bloomberg. And it's just one stop that he had in Providence, Rhode Island, because the governor there, Gina Raimondo, a former venture capitalist who at the time was about to become the first governor to endorse Bloomberg right there in Rhode Island. So he shows up. And this is the way New York Magazine describes it. "The would-be savior of the Democrat Party is resting in a car. Punctual and perfectionistic, the kind of guy who has advised people not to take bathroom breaks, and once said, 'I don't have anything in common with people who stand on escalators.'" You know, he just transports himself. Bloomberg had arrived early in his plane, his private plane, and soon strides up to the cafe alongside the Rhode Island governor, Gina Raimondo. Raimondo and Bloomberg inch toward a counter to buy coffee as his team scurries into position. An advanced man in a spotless suit who mentions John Mellencamp just endorsed Bloomberg, a recent grad in pearl earrings who now isn't sure that she can take a post-Super Tuesday vacation to Tulum, and then as the cashier shoots Bloomberg a wary look, he picks up a packet of gluten-free energy balls. "Will I feel better afterwards?" he asks. He reaches into his pocket for a nondescript black wallet from which he does not take out $60 billion, but only a $20 bill, and leaves a healthy tip. "Well," he says, turning to the restaurant's owner, "we got back late from Philadelphia, then I unpacked because I was away for 4 or 5 days, and by the time you put everything back," he trails off, "and I read for a few minutes, which was a mistake, so I could use some more energy." The owner begins evangelizing about plant-based nutrition and about opening a location in New York City. Then Bloomberg just starts to talk. "I was up in Maine and Vermont recently. Look at the foliage, that kind of thing. They have a dinner we go to. The food was really good. I said, we should have those diners in New York. We've had a lot of diners close. It's partially tastes have changed, but we've had 4 restaurants in my neighborhood close in the past 6 months. Each one was in a townhouse. They're ripping them down, putting up these thin slivers of buildings. There's one 2 doors away from me. I had the developer and his wife over for dinner. He said they're getting $3,000 a square foot for 4,000 square feet. One floor, $12 million. He took the top floor for himself and he thinks he's going to move in. Nobody could pay that rent," somebody pipes up. He says a little self-consciously, "you know," and then he motors on. This kind of monologue, weird, unguarded, almost like it was scripted to illustrate how out of touch he is exactly what every political strategist in America pointed to when Bloomberg considered running for president in 2008, then in 2012, then in 2016. The guy could never win in America. The contempt, the elitism, the "I know better than you."
Using free speech to free minds. This is The David Knight Show.
Just one more reminder about Mike Bloomberg as he's talking about the intelligentsia. You know, 4 years ago, the people didn't like the intelligentsia. Now they're coming back around. They say, "We don't want people like you telling us what to do, what to eat, what to drink, where to live, how to move around, or the fact that we can't move around." But now they want stability, he said. Well, we'll see, won't we? We'll see if they're able to get away with this with corona politics, because that's really the virus that they're now trying to spread. Very radical, I think, the change that we've seen from going back to 2013. Remember when we had the Ebola concern? And we were very concerned every time they would bring somebody in to the United States out of a hot spot. I mean, that was a disease that had 60 to 70% of the people dying, bleeding out of their nose and eyes and everywhere else. We haven't seen that kind of death rate. You know, what we've seen, as I pointed out last week, in China, from their statistics, going through first couple of months, they said nobody under the age of 9 has died. So that's one of the reasons why the parents in my generation, once somebody down the street got measles or chickenpox or whatever, they'd send us down to play with them. In the days when you would have children playing with each other in the neighborhood instead of all sitting on the couch watching TV, playing with video games, held captive. You know, you didn't get the police called on you if your kids were playing with other kids in the neighborhood. But we'd go down and play with them so we could get these childhood diseases because, as parents had explained, you don't want to get these diseases later in life because then they're really bad. You have a much, much worse time of it. And it creates, you have a higher risk of serious problems with that. And yet what we have today with the mandatory injections and the panic, I read for you just the account that happened just last week. They were freaked out that somebody got into LAX with measles. Said, look at this, 34 people in contact with this one person with measles, and we've had to quarantine them and so forth. I mean, they're as panicked about measles as they are about the coronavirus, and that offers me a glimmer of hope in one respect, in the respect of the disease. But it also offers concern because we look at just how authoritarian, how crazy they are in the way they're responding with measles. And I think they're going to use this coronavirus as a weapon to ratchet up vaccine mandates and, as I said last week, de facto quarantine, because now we've already got people saying, well, you shouldn't be allowed on an airplane if you're not vaccinated for the coronavirus. And they don't even have a coronavirus vaccine, but they've got it in the pipe. And they're testing it in Israel and elsewhere. So they're ready to roll this thing out. And once they do, they're going to say, well, you're not going to get out. You're not going to not only not go to school, you're not going to travel. You're not going to go to work. You're going to be banned out of the public square if you don't have the corona vaccine. That's what I'm concerned about. Things could get very rough. But before we leave Bloomberg completely, just remember this guy who's talking about how voters didn't like the intelligentsia. He has had a very long association with Harvey Weinstein. Weinstein had backed Bloomberg's political campaigns. Even after he switched parties and ran as a Republican, he still was backed by Harvey Weinstein. Harvey Weinstein had previously backed Democrat candidate Mark Green. He had hosted a fundraiser attended by Bill and Hillary Clinton, and then he switched to Bloomberg. And he even made phone calls to supporters on behalf of Bloomberg. Can you imagine being on the receiving end of a call from Harvey Weinstein? Oh, I'd like to get that on tape. What kind of a conversation was involved in that? Was it threats about how you'd never work in this town again if you didn't vote for Bloomberg? He was also included on Bloomberg's charity board. Yeah, these guys are very close. Nevertheless, Bloomberg spokesman said they were never close. Never close. So now they're trying to distance themselves from Harvey Weinstein. But let's take a look at what's going on with the corona politics as President Trump and the White House are saying the media hopes that this virus will bring down President Trump. Mick Mulvaney said, we took extraordinary steps 4 or 5 weeks ago. Why didn't we hear about it? Well, what was going on 4 or 5 weeks ago? Impeachment. And that was all that the press wanted to talk about. So while real news was happening and we were dealing with it in a way I think that you would be extraordinarily proud of. And he said the reason that they're paying so much attention to it today is that they think this is going to bring down the president. That's what this is all about. And I think that's very true. As I said last week, you look at the Ebola outbreak in 2013, and everything was tamped down. It was also done with the swine flu, the H1N1 swine flu. And I had that. Everybody in my family had it. And it was just another flu. And yet, you had Joe Biden saying in a press conference, I don't know, I'm not getting on a plane, not with the swine flu out there. And within an hour, the Obama administration and the Obama White House had called him on the carpet, and he held a press conference and did a retraction of that and said, I don't want to panic anybody. Well, fine, I understand. I think that that was a real threat either. I think Joe Biden was clueless about what was going on, as he is with so many different things. But when Ebola came around, as I pointed out, you got 60-70% of the people dying. And with the Chinese stats in terms of age, you've got nobody dying under the age of 9 from coronavirus. you had a fatality rate of 8% for people in their 70s and a fatality rate of 15% for people in their 80s. So if you're elderly, you know, it gets much, much higher. And yet, even for the elderly, even for people in their 80s, it's about a quarter to a fifth of what Ebola was. And yet the Obama administration was telling everybody, don't worry about Ebola. It's fine. We got it taken care of. Even though we're bringing in people, even though we're taking them to American hospitals, even though we've got a patient that we found with it living in an apartment in Dallas. Remember, we had the Dallas official go there, no protective clothing, walking around, then going to a press conference after he'd been walking around in that apartment complex. Don't panic. Everything is fine. It's just Ebola. And now we got coronavirus. And we haven't really had a chance to look at the actual health effects of this disease. Again, you know, a 15% death rate amongst people who are 80 years old. Yet they are spreading that around as panic. When we look at Michael Bloomberg, he is one of the people who is trying to capitalize on this the most. Let's play a little bit of video clip number 3, where he is trying to present himself as if he is president to show how he can lead us in a crisis when all we really want is stability and we need somebody like him to tell us what to do. Here's Bloomberg's commercial.
Good evening. I know this has been a very worrisome week for many Americans. The coronavirus is spreading and the economy is taking a hit. Markets have fallen because of uncertainty. At times like this, it's the job of the president to reassure the public that he or she is taking all the necessary steps to protect the health and well-being of every citizen.
Because see,
the public wants to know their leader
right?
is trained, informed, and respected. When a problem arises, they want someone in charge who can marshal facts and expertise to confront the problem. They want him or her to prepare for events like these in advance with teams of experts. Communications must be honest and transparent so people can be confident that professionals are in charge. Trust is essential.
Let's hold it right there. Yeah.
Government's
We're going to get
resources
teams of experts, professionals in charge. We're going to marshal our forces. Martial law? That's really what he's alluding to here. He knows better than you. You need somebody like him, an expert, because you're nothing but an ignorant rube. But of course, on the other hand, if we have a lot of people who die from coronavirus, and I don't think that's going to happen, I'm really concerned about quarantines. I'm concerned about panic and economic shortage based on the fear-mongering that they're doing. But if we did have a lot of people die, just think about this. We got 1,600 dead people in Pittsburgh, residents who are now registered to vote. So if we have a lot of casualties, be aware of the fact that these people may be changing their registration post-mortem to Democrat, and that may help Michael Bloomberg. We'll be right back. Stay with us. And dealing with fools like you, says Bloomberg, I can steal you blind. I think he already has, but I think he's going to step this up. One of the richest men in the world. How did he get that money? Well, we're about to find out how he gets even more wealthy if he wins. But let's take a look at the corona panic, as you just saw Michael Bloomberg doing a 3-minute ad talking about how he's the leader that we need in a crisis because he's going to kick the soda pop out of your hands. Kick you to the curb as well. We have nothing short of panic that is happening now. And again, just think back to the Ebola crisis of 2013, how these people tamped down. And don't worry about it. It's just Ebola. You know, they're just bleeding out of their eyes. So what, right? Only 60, 70% of the people dying, right? So what? And yet even with the elderly in China, 15% dying. That's the worst casualties in terms of demographics. It looks like an intense form of the flu. But just take a look at what people are doing. We now got the World Health Organization, the WHO, is now encouraging people. You know, it was last week they were telling everybody, shave your beards. And I said, no thanks. And now it's not just shaving my beard. They now want me to come up with alternative greetings like the elbow tap and the foot shake to fight off the coronavirus. Yes, this is as humanity struggles to adapt to the coronavirus outbreak. And of course, you can also use a wave. You can just say, hi, you know, just wave or use an elbow rub. This is how crazy it's getting, folks. It's getting to the point where it's real crazy, but there are real economic consequences that are coming down the road. And there are real concerns about authoritarian measures being imposed on us. For example, Switzerland on Friday canceled football matches, carnival celebrations, concerts, and even the Geneva International Motor Show. They have suspended all public and private events with more than 1,000 participants. There you go. Their people are greeting each other with a foot tap. they are suspending all public and private events with more than 1,000 participants, and they're using emergency powers to do so. See, I think this is an opportunity. This is being hyped up for two reasons. It's being hyped up, again, to come after President Trump to try to paint him as incompetent and out of touch. But they're also using this as President Trump. You know, the other danger is that President Trump is going to be goaded into doing some authoritarian moves that are then going to set a precedent. I'm very concerned about that. We see this being done across Europe. In France, we see the Louvre closing as the virus is spreading to new fronts. I wonder if they're going to put a face mask over the Mona Lisa. I wouldn't be surprised, considering the fact that they're telling us that we got to do elbow rubs and foot taps to greet each other. The coronavirus outbreak is causing Delta Airlines to suspend all flights to Milan from New York's JFK starting today. And they announced this yesterday. So if they're that concerned, why didn't they cancel it yesterday, right? But no, they're going to be doing it today. They'll be doing it for 2 months because of coronavirus fear. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And so as they suspend flights to Milan, in Milan, you've got a lot of people there speaking out about it. Sick of Italy's virus shutdown, Milan itches to get back to work, writes AFP. Usually a bustling economic and fashion capital has now been paralyzed by a virus that has killed 29 and infected more than 1,000 people in Italy since breaking out just 37 miles south of the city a week ago. Now, think about that. And again, as I pointed this out last week, when we look at fatality rates, consider the fact that they're not testing everybody if they've got a minor outbreak of this or something. So, again, the cases are underreported. So the casualty rates are going to be inflated if you say, well, I've got 1,000 people and 29 people died. That's 2.9% fatality rate. But what if it's not 1,000 people has got it, but if it's 3,000 people or 10,000 people that have it? Well, if you knew that, then your fatality rate would be much lower. As one person who owns a bar, the Jamaica Bar, said the situation is pretty dramatic. He said, we are very well known with the Jamaica Bar. Still, things are pretty dramatic for us. I can't begin to imagine what other people are going through. He said, hysteria is very dangerous for the economy. That's the bottom line. Hysteria is very dangerous. Another individual there said the mood was approaching psychosis. Think about this. Think about the ability of the press and politicians to stampede the crowds. We've already seen evidence of this with the empty store shelves. It's something you should really be concerned about. Photos of deserted, nearly empty airports around the world show how coronavirus has decimated air travel. The International Air Transport Association has predicted a $29.3 billion loss in passenger revenue this year because of the COVID-19. Empty streets, economic turmoil as virus alters daily life in Japan and elsewhere. Entire UK cities could be placed on lockdown in a bid to contain the spread. And then we see what happens in California. Anxious shoppers are stocking up on supplies. And I said this from the very beginning. I said back in North Carolina, whenever somebody would predict that we're going to have a snow day, single snow day, they were not equipped, with snow removal equipment. And so when the snow would come, everything would shut down. Everybody would stay home from work and from school. But even as the snow was falling, people would run out and empty the shelves of milk and bread and other things like that. Because, you know, that snow could last for an entire day or so. I mean, things may get much worse with this. And one of the things that we need to be concerned about is how they're going to use this to make the case for more authoritarian government or even for world government. Story from Zero Hedge. Does the coronavirus make the case for world government? You're going to hear that case made. It's not going to be very long before they're making this case. Cross-border outbreaks of illnesses are particularly well-suited to the pre-existing bureaucratic desire for power over the population. It makes the public much more willing to accept forced quarantines and arrests for non-compliance, forced immunization, and voluntary commitment to state facilities where you can really get sick and die. Curfews, restrictions on business operations and travel, import controls. It also allows public health officials to commandeer and to manage efforts to find the cure. Who then take credit when the virus eventually relents? These are the sort of things that authoritarian politicians want all the time. That's why you see Michael Bloomberg out there. Oh, yes. People didn't want us telling them what to do, but now they're begging for us to tell them what to do. They're begging for me, somebody like me, to save them from Washington because, you know, that's the only place that we can be saved from this type of thing. We have to have some savior in Washington, D.C., protect us from the coronavirus. And even better, we need to have some globalist structure to save us from this type of global pandemic. Crises simply provide an opportunity to ratchet up their power and also to accustom the public to being ordered around and taking cues from centralized government sources. You know, remember, as Bloomberg was saying this when we were talking about the farmers, you know, the context of those remarks, to be fair to him, what he was really talking about, he wasn't just coming after the farmers. He's coming after all of us, essentially. So, yeah, we had the agrarian society, you know, for millennia. And that's no complicated thing. Then that was replaced by the Industrial Revolution. That's no complicated thing either. But now we have the smart people like me as part of the information society. And now this information society is there to replace people with computers. But we've got to find a way to keep them from coming after us with guillotines. That was the full context of the remarks. And quite frankly, folks, it's much worse than him just coming after farmers with an arrogance and an elitist detachment. No, he's pushing full-on technocracy and soft kill and control of the population. So this is ideal for a demagogue authoritarian like Michael Bloomberg. And as I point out, just when they push this, just think about the fact that even in China, highly authoritarian China, they're saying that they can't contain the virus. And when you're poor because you have given up all your economic freedoms, it makes it even worse because of poor quality of health care. All right, we've got to go to break, and then we're going to come back and talk more about the coronavirus. We'll also talk about the Green New Steel. But folks, right now is a time for you to prep. Seriously think about this. This is an opportunity for you to think about how prepared you are to try to isolate yourself as much as possible from these authoritarian control structures, that they're going to use this to impose on you. This is just the beginning. So you need to prepare. Whether this is going to be something that they're going to pull the trigger on or whether it'll be the next thing down, this may just be a preparatory run for them. Or it may be the one that they pull the stops out. If it is, you need to prepare for this. And if it isn't, you'll have the storable food for 25 years. Take a look at InfoWarsStore.com. We have our select storable food. Right now, demand has gone up to an unprecedented amount. It can take right now potentially 8 weeks or more, and it's getting longer by the day. So take a look at InfoWarsStore.com. Make sure you prepare for now and for the next 25 years if necessary.
Broadcasting with the power of the First Amendment. It's the David Knight Show.
Welcome back. You know, even here in Austin, South by Southwest is supposed to kick off in just a couple of weeks. Organizers said the coronavirus will not change how Austin is preparing for the South by Southwest Festival. Staff at the airport here said the CDC doesn't think that Austin's airport needs more screening. Meanwhile, we've had the China gathering cancel South by Southwest 2020 because of China's coronavirus outbreak. What that is essentially a special event of Chinese entrepreneurs South by Southwest. and they've decided that so few of them are going to be attending that they have just decided they will cancel that. And you have people here in Austin putting out a petition to cancel South by Southwest. Now, I'm not concerned about the coronavirus here, but I am concerned about South by Southwest. I would sign that petition, not because I'm concerned about the coronavirus, because I just want that thing shut down. The question is it going to shut down the economy? And we now have the guy that is called Dr. Doom, Rubini. He is the guy who predicted the housing bubble burst in 2008 and the ramifications of austerity measures with that for Greece. He now believes the coronavirus will lead to a global economic disaster and that President Trump will not be reelected as a result. He said the Democratic field is very poor, but Trump is dead. Quote me on that. Quote me on that. That's what they're pinning their hopes on. Just consider that. The Democrats are so out of touch, so elitist, so Marxist, so authoritarian, totalitarian, that the only way that they can get elected is if we have a global pandemic and an economic shutdown. That should tell you something. It should also tell you something. Bill Gates is out there saying that this is a once-in-a-century pathogen. Or did he say opportunity? This is a guy who has been at the center of these annual war games for bioweapons, right? Either an accidental release or a terrorist release or an attack, right? Or maybe it's just something that, you know, just happened to mutate into a chimera, genetic chimera, by accident. Yeah, that doesn't happen. But they've been wargaming on this, and that's why I said from the very beginning, we go back and we look at the war game that they had this last fall, always pushing out, typically it's a coronavirus type of thing, a flu virus type of thing. And yet, when you look at these games, that's why I went back and played, not even just this most recent one, but I took one from a couple of years ago. And I played a little bit of clips. What they do is they have people from all of these government organizations training as to how they're going to react to this. See, this is not something where, gee, President Trump didn't think that anything like this would happen. No, unfortunately, he didn't shut down our bioweapons program. And nobody's even talking about that. In spite of the fact that we had UNC Chapel Hill, just down the street from where I used to live, was putting together a chimera, coronavirus plus Chinese bat, the two things right there. In 2015, they released their research paper funded by the federal government, the National Institutes of Health, even though Congress had said 2 years earlier, we don't want any more funding for creating dangerous, unnatural organisms like this. Everybody called it a chimera. And people in the industry were saying, what's going on with this? This is not only unethical, but it's now illegal. And they're doing this openly and bragging about it. And you had the National Institutes of Health say, yeah, well, you know, we just decided we'd go ahead and do this. You don't think the military is doing that? You don't think that the end game of all of this war gaming that's being done with people in the Pentagon, people in these health agencies and so forth throughout the federal bureaucracy, they always tell them you have to act more quickly. And you have to act with more draconian measures, and you have to remove the impediments to us vaccinating people, not having any tests. We've got to stop this right away. That's the bottom line. That's why Bill Gates is so excited.
In a world of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And now, the David Knight Show.
Welcome back. We have NASA images showing how pollution has cleared over China. I think this is interesting for a number of reasons. These are satellite pictures taken from NASA and the European Space Agency. They use pollution monitoring satellites to track nitrogen dioxide levels. Now, isn't it interesting that they've never shown us these pictures before? When we've got all of this Paris Climate Accord debate going on, we don't want to see all the pollution coming from China. That's what it looks like. Look at that, as you see up there on the screen. Scroll that over. Look at all those red, all those orange and deep orange and almost black areas. That's the heavy pollution in China. Now roll it back the other way. This is what it looks like today. Basically nothing. They have completely shut down their industry in China. I think it tells you, you know, where the pollution is coming from, doesn't it? You know, we, as President Trump said, why doesn't Greta go to China and lecture them or to India? Because when you look at the Paris Climate Accord, they were given a pass. They said, you don't have to do anything to clean up your factories, your power plants. As a matter of fact, you can build more of those without any pollution controls whatsoever. And if you look at India, if you have a internal combustion engine that gets more than 30 miles per gallon in India, that is cleaner than if you were to run an electric car off of their dirty power grid. But see, the Paris Climate Accord didn't do anything to clean that up. The whole thing was just to, it was a globalist ploy to move, take away what little bit of industrialization we still had left in America. And they've been very quiet about the fact that we have reduced our emissions more than any other country. I've got that story coming up. And we did it without shutting everything down, as China did. And so when I look at this, I'm beginning to wonder if this is, wait for it, a conspiracy. I'm serious. I mean, you look at why they're shutting this down. And clearly, you know, we had a lot of reports that, hey, you know, are they running incinerators to get rid of the bodies and so forth? That's what a lot of people were putting out. And yet we're not seeing anything coming out of those areas now, right? So they still haven't opened up industry, and yet it appears that they're not running big cremation factories there to try to get rid of the bodies. So the question is, why are they keeping this still locked down? The Chinese don't want Trump in office for another 4 years. If they can shut this down, it's probably worth the gambit to them. Just remember, you know, we looked at the initial collapse in 2008. I remember when it happened. I remember the banks just one day saying, well, you know, I think we're going to cut back on loans. I think we're overextended in California. Just boom. That was just their decision. It's like, why are they doing this and collapsing the mortgage market? Because they're holding the mortgages, right? It's going to hurt the banks. Except, of course, it didn't play out that way, did it? Because what the banks were able to do was get bailed out by the government. And then they were able to buy up this stuff at a fire sale price. It's kind of the way they always operate. The way they would engineer runs on the banks in order to establish the Federal Reserve. That's what J.P. Morgan did, as I pointed out. You know, we looked at the 100-year anniversary of the creation of the Federal Reserve. You know, he operated in the same way that they had Potter, the banker, and It's a Wonderful Life, because he was patterned after J.P. Morgan. Everybody understood what he had done. He had engineered these banking runs and then used that to say, well, we got to have a Federal Reserve so we can have stability. They create a crisis, and then they already have their centralized authoritarian plan for controlling your life in place that they put in based on that crisis that they created. And so I'm very concerned about what may really be behind this. The economic effects are very real. I'm not sure about this virus and how serious it is. Again, the difference in concentrations of nitrogen dioxide in these two maps that you see back to back, almost no nitrogen dioxide visible after China imposed a lockdown in Wuhan and many cities in Hubei province. You can see they've basically shut down all industry there. And so Forbes is writing yesterday, coronavirus could be the end of China as a global manufacturing hub. You know, in the same way that the banking crisis bankrupted the big banks that had created it, right? Oh, no, that didn't happen, did it? They used that to destroy mid-sized and small banks. They had Elizabeth Warren come in after the fact, and so we're going to set up the Consumer Financial Protection Board. And we're going to come up with all kinds of new rules and regulations, which basically meant that small and medium-sized banks couldn't afford to do the paperwork to grant these loans, and they just had to exit the market. The big guys, on the other hand, had armies of accountants, and they could set up these and they could comply with these regulations until their competitors get out of business, and then they can remove those regulations with their bought and paid for politicians. And so when we look at this and we think about what happened in the 2008 crisis, again, Rubini saying, wow, this is going to be just like that, and it's going to take out Trump. They took out a lot of independent banks, a lot of different businesses, but the people who were not hurt were the people who had actually precipitated the crisis. So is this going to hurt China as they have created this crisis? I mean, it looks like a self-inflicted wound. It wouldn't be the first time that a Chinese communist dictator has done a self-inflicted wound. You had Mao starve 50 million people for no reason at all. They didn't have a virus. They didn't have any reason for doing it. They just did it because they could. And so why are they doing this? The new coronavirus, COVID-19, will end up being the final curtain on China's nearly 30-year role as the world's leading manufacturer, writes Forbes magazine yesterday. Using China as a hub? That model died this week, I think, said Vladimir Signorelli, head of Bretton Woods Research. Well, we shall see about that. Meanwhile, Lawrence Kudlow, with the Trump administration now, he's the top White House economist, he said on Friday, investors should start thinking about getting back into the stock market as the Dow Jones Industrial Average was on track towards its worst weekly loss since 2008. Yeah, big retraction last week. It went beyond correction. And so he is trying to encourage people to look at this as a buying opportunity. I'm just concerned, you know, when we look at these things, I don't think that there's anything that is beyond the pale of manipulation. And that includes the global economy. You know, we saw this happen with so many different items, haven't we? I mean, as soon as Bitcoin became a commodity traded on the Chicago Commodity Exchange, what'd they do? They manipulated it. It was very easy to do because it had a very small market cap. You know, you take a look at the value of Bitcoin, even though it was trading at record levels, there was, you know, look at the outstanding coins times the price per coin. It still was not a lot of money. Any number of actors could have manipulated it. In concert, it was a piece of cake for them to manipulate it. And now you look at the Chinese economy. All it takes is a central dictator who decides that he wants to shut things down and manipulate the U.S. election. Is it manipulation of the U.S. election? Is it manipulation of the global economy? Will this be the end of China? Do you think that this is going to cause the globalists to give up on their idea of using slave labor? I don't think so. I think that they aren't ready to roll out the robots yet. Once they get the robots rolled out, yeah, they will get rid of slave labor. Maybe they already have the robots in sufficient quantity that they can roll them out, just like they rolled out all of those body scanners after the fake underwear bomber. They already had them manufactured. They already had them in the warehouses. You know, just like 9/11. We never saw, except for a few, if you paid any attention, you would see that they were using remote control of airplane, of commercial airliners to test them in crash videos for decades. But nobody had ever heard anything about drone warfare, anything like that, until 9/11. Then weeks later, all of a sudden, it just magically appear. Had this stuff in the wings all the time. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. As we saw over the weekend, again, let's talk just briefly about the health effects of the corona disease. We talked about the politics behind it. We talked about the economics behind it, the panic behind it. Yeah, just don't touch people. Don't shake hands. By all means, don't kiss each other. Don't shake hands. Just use elbow rubs, foot taps, shave your beards, etc. This is the panic that's being sold to us by the World Health Organization, the WHO. Don't get fooled again. We've got 52 people in Washington State nursing home over the weekend. that have coronavirus symptoms. Two of them test positive. Nearby, they had the first death from coronavirus, a 50-year-old man. And so when we look at this, yes, we're going to see clusters like this where people are confined. And that's my big concern, as we saw with the Diamond Princess cruise ship. Once you put people in that kind of confinement, which people like Michael Bloomberg could very well dictate that, and they could goad President Trump into doing something like that just to show that he is doing something about this. That's what you have to worry about. This is what the health bureaucracies and the military have been training on an annual basis to do. React very quickly, react overboard instead of underreacting. You know, they always, the bottom line of all these annual simulations that are usually funded by Bloomberg and John Hopkins, as well as the Gates Foundation, the bottom line is, I say, well, you moved too slowly, you didn't move quickly enough, and you were too slow in terms of approving our new experimental vaccines. And you got to put these people in confinement. And when you do that, as we saw with the Diamond Princess, it actually made things worse. It could be making things worse in these nursing homes. This is something that you should really be concerned about. New York State admits its first confirmed COVID-19 case as a global deaths past 3,000 and so forth. Well, there's an article on Zero Hedge. Governments will use the coronavirus card to increase interventionism. The Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Global Cases Monitor shows that the mortality rate of the epidemic is very low. And what they do is, with their own figures, these people who were panicking about everything, saying, you know, shave your beards, tap your feet, don't touch other people except with your shoes. They're saying there's been 87,470 cases, 2,990 deaths, and 42,670 people have recovered. And as they point out, they're going to talk about those first two cases. Look, we've had 87,000 cases of it, and nearly 3,000 people have died. But they're not going to tell you that 43,000 people have recovered. They're not going to tell you that. The media will hype those first two figures. The government will hype it. They're using it for political purposes now. This has gone beyond any precaution. They never did this with Ebola. And the reality is that for those who are under 60 years old, the death rate is less than 1.3%. In the very young population, it's less than 0.2%. And on average, it's a maximum of 4%. Again, if you're in your 80s, 15%. So it is very much skewed towards your age and your health condition, as we have seen with the flu typically. Let's just take a look and imagine if we applied the same standard that's being applied to the coronavirus, if we applied it to some other things, for example, heart disease. According to the CDC, we have in America alone, now we're talking about, these are global figures that I just gave you that are coming out. And I know you say, well, I think China is lying about this. Probably are. They're probably lying about everything. And you know what? The World Health Organization is probably lying about everything, and the CDC is probably lying about everything as well. But let's go with their figures for heart disease, because they've got no reason to lie about that. They say that there's, in 2017, the most recent year, CDC says 647,000 deaths from heart disease. So that's about 54,000 people a month dying from heart disease in only the U.S., So just imagine for a moment, since we've had these figures accumulate, and they've accumulated them for 2 months worldwide, and we've had 3,000 people die, according to these figures. And that may or may not, that may be a high figure, it may be a low figure, we don't really know. But let's just go with it for right now. 3,000 people over 2 months, that would be equivalent, can you imagine if with heart disease, you know, we got 108,000 people dying in just the United States alone over those 2 months. What if we had 108,000 people die from the coronavirus? Can you imagine how authoritarian the panic would be, since they're shutting down airports, they're shutting down museums, sporting events, everything worldwide? You know, Japan, South Korea, France, Switzerland, so forth. Cancer, nearly as bad, 599,000 people. And we've had in the past, we've had the director of the EPA, in an effort to ban diesel engines, lied to the public and said, we've got more people dying from diesel fine particulate matter than we do from cancer. This would be equivalent to finding a cure for cancer if we could ban diesel engines. And at the same time, UNC And the EPA there in North Carolina, Research Triangle Park, were running tests. They were trying to find people with heart disease and respiratory diseases and hook them up to fine particulate matter. They would pull out the carbon monoxide out of the tailpipe, but then give them the rest of the stuff and do it at 70 times the rate that they said would cause severe health problems. And even at that, they only had two or three people that got sick. But they were experimenting on humans. They were doing exactly the same thing in a very concentrated way, 72 times more than what they had said would be bad. They were giving to these people at the same time they were telling everybody, we're killing people. Not getting sick, we're killing people, said Lisa Jackson with then Congressman Markey. So, you know, we could look at heart disease, we could look at cancer, we could look at diabetes. You know, we got 83,000 people dying a year in America from diabetes. That's about 6,900 people a month. Over a two-month period, like this coronavirus outbreak, that's about 14,000 people. Are we shutting down the production and the injection of high fructose corn syrup into everything that you eat or drink in America? Of course not. Not going to do anything about that. Or take a look, finally, at influenza and pneumonia. According to the CDC figures, in 2017, we had 55,672 people die. So that's about 4,600 people a month dying from flu and pneumonia. Over a two-month period, like we're talking about with the coronavirus, that'd be 9,283 people dying of flu and pneumonia. Have we had that many people die worldwide of the coronavirus? No. We've had one-third that number die of the coronavirus worldwide as to what we typically expect to have die just in the United States alone. So you need to take a look at this. You need to take a look at things that you can do to increase your health if you're concerned about the health effects of this. But you also need to look at how this is being used economically and politically for an agenda. There's something much bigger going on here than this little disease. If you're worried about flu, I mean, going back to before the coronavirus came out, there was a study about elderberries blocking the flu virus from attaching to and entering human cells. Unique phytochemicals found in elderberries. We know that vitamin D is very effective in terms of helping you to fight cold and flu. So take a look at things that are going to help your health. But you better also prepare for what this endgame is. I don't know what they're planning here economically and politically, but that's why we're stocked up on storable food, and you need to be doing that as well. You can still get it at InfoWarsStore.com. We haven't raised the prices yet, but folks, you need to prepare for this stuff.
The mainstream propaganda. It's the David Knight Show.
One of the other things that's happened over the weekend, of course, is talks about a peace in Afghanistan. This is something that was a campaign issue for President Trump as he was a candidate. It's something that Rand Paul has been very vocal about in recent weeks, especially stepping up the rhetoric. And now on Saturday, we had the U.S. peace envoy and the Taliban's top political leaders shaking hands, signing a peace agreement between the Taliban and the U.S. officials in Qatar on Saturday. It'll set the stage, they said, for the final withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan after 19 years there. Violence that has killed more than 3,500 Americans and coalition troops, tens of thousands of Afghans. After the U.S. invaded Afghanistan after September 11th, 2001. And, of course, it also is $750 billion, they say. I think it's much higher than that. But who's counting? I mean, we're talking about the Pentagon here, right? It's just pieces of paper. And if the debt gets too big, then we just fly some kind of a missile into the side of the Pentagon where they're doing the accounting. No problem with that. But we immediately had Mike Pompeo throwing cold water on it. He said, this agreement will mean nothing, and today's good feelings will not last if we don't take concrete actions on commitments and promises that have been made. I know there will be a temptation to declare victory, but victory for Afghans, will only be achieved when they can live in peace and prosper. Is this the purpose of the U.S. Defense Department? Have they been winning any battles in Afghanistan? Are they controlling more or less territory? Their control of territory in Afghanistan has collapsed. There's absolutely no way for them to achieve a military victory. Nobody in the Pentagon will make that case, and Rand Paul has been pointing that out. And yet you see the war hawks, people like Lindsey Graham, people like Mike Pompeo, absolutely pouring cold water on them. Oh, we got to stay the course. We got to get victory. Well, why don't you specifically define what victory means? I mean, does that mean that every last Taliban member or radical jihadist has to be exterminated out of Afghanistan, Mike? Why don't you define that for us? So they won't define what victory is. They didn't do it before we invaded the country. Meanwhile, you've got Secretary of Defense Mark Esper traveled to the capital of Afghanistan, Kabul, Saturday, to appear beside the Afghan president and the NATO Secretary General for a joint declaration. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said, thanks to President Trump's leadership, we are finally making substantial progress toward ending our nation's longest war. Today's release of the joint declaration between the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and the United States marks a pivotal moment in the peace process. Nevertheless, you still have Mike Pompeo out there saying it's going to be rocky and it's going to be bumpy. No one is under any false illusion that this won't be a difficult conversation. It's not going to happen. Every time President Trump says, I'm going to get out of Afghanistan, he says, well, you know, he makes these pronouncements, says Pompeo. And then we get together with him and then we talk about this. President Trump is still pushing this, but you're still going to have people like Mike Pompeo making the case. Well, they didn't live up to their agreement, so we got to stop this. The agreement, by the way, will commit the U.S. to begin withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan in exchange for the Taliban sitting down to peace negotiations with other Afghans and severing their ties with groups like al-Qaeda. Many of the steps in the deal are conditioned on actions being taken on both sides. A week-long deal to reduce violence will continue, said officials, as the U.S. immediately draws down its approximately 13,000 troops in Afghanistan to 8,600 and closes five military bases within 135 days. Army withdrawal of U.S. forces beyond 8,600, however, is contingent on the Taliban meeting its commitments, but it sets out a timeline for the full U.S. and NATO withdrawal within 14 months. And a senior administration official said this is an aspirational timeline for withdrawal. In other words, they don't really think that they're going to do this. And we've got people, again, like Mike Pompeo, who lie, cheat, steal, have classes on how to do that. They're going to make sure that this is not going to happen. Already, the Afghan peace deal has hit a snag over Taliban prisoner releases. Afghanistan's president said Sunday that he will not free thousands of Taliban prisoners ahead of all Afghan power-sharing talks set for this week, publicly disagreeing with a timetable for a speedy prisoner release laid out just a day earlier in the U.S.-Taliban peace agreement. So you have to ask, if they have no military solution that they can fall back on, if there is no military path to victory, there's no military path to peace either. What is the end game on this? Well, again, this is not even coming from the Taliban side. This is coming from the Afghan administration that's there. And they don't want to see this end either, because the Afghanistan president, who is throwing this down and saying, I'm not going to release any Taliban prisoners, he realizes that since the Taliban controls most of Afghanistan now, he's not going to be controlling the government, so he wants to make sure that this isn't going to go through. People like Mike Pompeo and others in the administration who want to keep every war that we have, and we've got 8 or 10 of these things, who knows how many of them we've got, because we've had them added by Barack Obama, but we can't get rid of any of these wars, and they don't want any of them to stop. They want them to all go on perpetually, and they're going to do everything both in not just because it's the Trump administration, it's because this is the permanent government, the real government, the permanent bureaucracy. You can call it the swamp. I call it the black hole, because that's really what it is. They suck all power and money, all life and liberty out of the rest of America into that black hole we call Washington. And they're going to continue to throw military lives and taxpayer money down that black hole. They have absolutely no intention of shutting this down. I'm glad about the aspirational aspects of this. And I'm sure President Trump will use this as a statement to say look, I said we're going to get out of Afghanistan. We started the process already, and we'll be out of there shortly after I get reelected. But the reality is that one day later, you've already got the corrupt Afghanistan government throwing a monkey wrench in this. You have a veterans group, however, praising Trump for the peace agreement and chiding Chicken Hawk Cheney. This is Sergeant Dan McKnight, Afghanistan war veteran, founder of BringOurTroopsHome.us. On Saturday, he praised President Trump and the announcement of the peace agreement with the Taliban forces. He said, after nearly two decades, we're grateful that our commander-in-chief stood with the American people and with America's fighting men and women and their families. The only problem is that I'm not exactly sure that President Trump is the commander-in-chief, that any president is the commander-in-chief. I think the military-industrial complex is firmly in charge, and so is the intelligence funds. As a matter of fact, we had Tulsi Gabbard talking about how the presidential candidates must condemn election interference by, not Russians, but election interference by U.S. intelligence agencies. Again, dropping another truth bomb from Tulsi Gabbard. The real people, the real manipulation of our elections is being conducted by the military-industrial complex, is being conducted by the U.S. intelligence agencies. They are the ones who are really rigging our election. And folks, if you don't understand this, and if you don't understand that the military-industrial complex has now become the military Silicon Valley complex, just take a look at the fact that they're not only going to control our news. You know, we had DARPA work with Microsoft to set up NewsGuard, and DARPA is also funding along, you know, through Microsoft, they're funding ElectionGuard. They're going to count the votes. They're not only going to manipulate the election by manipulating the news that you're allowed to hear, labeling anybody that questions the official government narrative as propaganda, but they're actually going to control the vote totals. This is coming out of DARPA through Microsoft. Tulsi Gabbard is exactly right. The people who are interfering with our election are the U.S. intelligence agency, the military Silicon Valley complex. Welcome back as we see the latest escalation in the federal government's war against free speech as we're going to break. I was talking about how DARPA is using Microsoft to shut down free speech and news. They have NewsGuard, and if they don't like you, if you question the official government story about enough things, they will label you as a false source of information. And so when you go to the various browsers that are now putting these plugins in, whether you're talking about Chrome or you're talking about Microsoft's browser, they will put a red flag up there. Don't pay any attention to this website or to this individual. That's happened to me on Twitter. I was sent a screenshot. Somebody had installed the new Chrome browser, and then they went to my Twitter feed, and it was just red flags all over the place. Everything this guy says is a lie. That kind of simple-minded propaganda that only deserves to be in the Soviet Union is now being propagated by the National Science Foundation. This is the current National Science Foundation director is an Obama appointee, France Cordova. The NSF's budget in 2020 has increased by 2.5% over the previous year. They're getting $8 billion. That's money we could be used to, I don't know, build the wall or something. I don't know. $8 billion, $8.25 billion. The entire ICE budget is $6 billion. And the National Science Foundation is getting $8 billion. And you say, well, yeah, but science. I mean, we should be spending money on science, because if the federal government doesn't fund science, we wouldn't have science. Well, maybe we don't have science when it comes to this report. Maybe what we have here is manipulation and propaganda, right? Again, you know, we look at the size of these budgets, uh, uh, billion for ICE, $8.25 billion for the NSF. And how are they using these funds? As Gab pushes back on this, because they focused on Gab. And what they did was they released a report. They called it the Gab Hate Corpus. In other words, the body of Gab hate. They collected 27,000 different posts that they believe were hate speech. And yet, as Gab pointed out, they said this is 27,000 posts out of 93 million posts on the website. They take 27,000 out of 93 million and say, look at that. Gab is a hate site. That's basically 0.029%. And they want to use that to promote censorship of Gab. Why? Why do they want to censor Gab? Because Gab is not censoring you. Gab has over 3 million visitors, users, and customers from around the world, they said. Our fastest growing markets are in the U.S., India, and Spain. Our users have diverse ideological, cultural, and social perspectives. Studies like this seek to gaslight millions of great people in our community based on a negligible fraction of posts on the site. Again, 0.029%. And they use that to say, we've got to shut down Gab. We've got to do something about that. It's interesting to me that we look at where this stuff is coming from, the National Science Foundation, run by an Obama holdover and having its budget increased every year. We also see it coming out of places like Indiana University. They had, as they were identifying bots and hate speech and so forth, they have a project called Oh So Me, social media, they monitor. They have another couple of things. They have bot or not, where they rate people or different social media users as to whether or not they're a bot. And, of course, if you've posted anything that the left doesn't like, you've been accused of being a bot. They have a bot-ometer. And the guy who's running this was pulled out of, I think it was Italy. It was out of a European country. It's a researcher who's pulled out of Italy. He went first, interestingly enough, to the Kinsey sex cult there at the University of Indiana. This Oh So Me, bot or not, the botometer, all that's being run out of Indiana University, just like they've used the Kinsey Institute for the last 70 years to push sexual perversion and propaganda into our society. And this guy came over. He was part of the Kinsey Institute as well. Funny how these things always overlap, isn't it? And as we look at this, and as they say, no, no, you should not be allowed to have a platform where you speak freely. We've got to find some way to shut it down. Again, we have the Section 230 out of the Communications Decency Act, which says that a public forum like that is a digital public square. And the people who put that forum up and they're not producing the content, you know, that applies to YouTube, it applies to Facebook, it applies to Twitter, it also applies to Gab. Those people are not responsible for the content that other people put up, according to Section 230. That's why this is very dangerous when you see some conservatives in Congress saying we've got to remove Section 230. No, you don't. You don't do that to stop the censorship that's being conducted by Google, by Facebook, by Twitter. That's not a solution. These people are doing this on behalf of the government. DARPA and these various venture capital firms, some of them open about it, like, you know, CIA, once the internet became practical, they openly created a venture capital firm to create internet companies that were going to be compliant with them. The people behind this censorship are the intelligence community. Tulsi Gabbard was exactly right. They're manipulating the election. They're going to manipulate it with news and information and with censorship, and they're going to do it directly with Election Guard. And they're the ones who are behind this censorship. It's an absolute lie that this is something that's being done because this is their private property, and it is wrong for the courts to turn over the internet to be the private property of two or three corporations. This ought to be an outrage to everybody. All these liberals who say, well, you know, we don't want to have fascism and we don't like corporations, and yet they're cheering this whole scheme on, using these Silicon Valley companies as a glove over the iron fist of government censorship. Oh, the liberals like that, though. And then we look at education. You have a recent interview with Alex Newman, New American Magazine. Of course, they have a great magazine report, special report, Rescuing Our Children. I've interviewed Alex Newman multiple times about this. He's done a tour about this. But he had an interview with the former Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, Diane Douglas, and she got right to the heart of the matter. She said, this is part of a 100-year or 150-year battle for the souls of our children. John Dewey, the Dewey Decimal System, one of the people like Horace Mann that is worshipped in the educational establishment. John Dewey was very clear. His intent was to change our society and to make sure that our children were uneducated or undereducated. She said, reading is important because it allows children to learn on their own without any help, without any guidance from government. Frankly, if kids can read and do those basic things, they don't need a teacher again. She said they can learn anything they want to for the rest of their lives. See, if you can have free speech in a public forum and you can choose which news organizations to listen to or to pass around information yourself, you don't need the mainstream media. That's why they have to stop you from reading. If you can read, they've got to stop you from reading. They've got to shut the content down. And to see how this is a war on the very foundation of our culture, I'm very glad to see Buttigieg drop out of the race. I'm just concerned that he's going to come back in as a running mate of Joe Biden, because this guy is secretly at war with the foundations of our culture. His father made a lifetime career at Notre Dame out of promoting the works and glorifying and worshiping the works of the guy who founded Italy's Marxist Party, their Communist Party. And he is a closet Marxist. And their whole purpose is to tear down the culture and to eradicate religion. That's what his father, Buttigieg Sr., said, that you have to get rid of the hegemony of the bourgeoisie. In other words, you got to get rid of the power of the middle class. Well, how do you do that? Well, you destroy everything this country is built on. For example, Columbus, the discoverer, will soon be ousted from Discovery Park. They have to literally tear down the statues of our culture and erect their own monuments. And we see that happening literally as well as metaphorically when you got people like Bernie Sanders in the race. All right, we're just about out of time for the program today. I'll just remind you one more time, if you want to make sure that you are prepared, and you have to prepare if you want to maintain your independence. As I said before, my big concern about the coronavirus, I mean, look at it compared to typical flu numbers that are coming out of the CDC. It's nothing, nothing. And yet, they are shutting down, literally shutting down the entire global economy, starting with China. China has control over the global economy, and they can shut it down just like the banks blew up the economy when we had the mortgage crash, and they could do it to stop President Trump. And so you need to be sure that they're not going to corral you into quarantine. They're not going to be able to force you to take an untested vaccine. Make sure that you have independence for yourself, that you have prepared for yourself and your family. We still have storable food at InfoWarsStore.com, but we're getting unprecedented demand. And we're now 8 weeks out, and it's getting longer.